Gaza resistance movement Hamas elects Ismail Haniyeh as its leader for a second term. He has led Hamas since 2017. Afghan government forces engage in heavy fighting with Taliban militants to repel their assaults on several major cities. And people take to the streets in the Japanese capital to call for the cancellation of the Tokyo Olympic Games amid a rise in coronavirus cases. I'm Marzia Hashim. I appreciate you being with us. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has elected Ismail Haniyeh as its leader for a second term. The 59-year-old politician has led Hamas since 2017. Earlier, we were joined by our Gaza correspondent Ashraf Shannon for more on the story.
Hamas resistance movement has elected Mr. Ismail Haniyeh as the head of its political bureau. As of yesterday, and this is the second time that Hamas movement has elected Mr. Haniyeh. According to Hamas's charter, Mr. Haniyeh can be elected for three terms. So far, two terms. Meanwhile, Mr. Khaled Mash'al is in charge of Hamas's international relations, and his deputy is Dr. Musa Abu Marzouk, while Mr. Saleh Al-Aruri is in charge of Hamas movement in the occupied West Bank. While in the Gaza Strip, Yahya Al-Sinwar is head of the Hamas movement in Gaza, and his deputy is Dr. Khalid Al-Hayya. It's worth mentioning that since Mr. Haniyeh attended the funeral of the late Iranian martyr, Brigadier General Qasem Soleimani, in January 2020, the Egyptian authorities have banned him from returning to the Gaza Strip.
At least 16 Palestinians held in Israeli jails have been on a hunger strike for up to 18 days now. They're protesting their detention without charge or trial. Israel is currently holding some 540 Palestinians without charge or trial. Earlier, we discussed this issue in our News Review program.
Time now for the News Review section in this news broadcast. At least 16 Palestinians languishing in Israeli jails have been on hunger strike for days in protest against their detention without charge or trial. Palestinian Commission for Detainees and Ex-Detainees Affairs says that some inmates are on strike for about 3 weeks. Figures show the regime continues to detain nearly 5,000 Palestinians, including women and children. Some 540 Palestinians are held without charge or trial under Israel's so-called administrative detention, a policy the regime renews after every 6 months to keep them behind bars. The administrative detention is deemed illegal under international law since the regime does not present any suspicion or evidence to justify those arrests. Okay, now joining me to discuss it a little bit will be a couple of guests. We'll have our correspondent Mona Kandel and Yaqubat Ramallah. Also, Saad Nim, professor of political science with Beirut University, joining us from Ramallah. Good to have you both. Let's go to Mona first. Bring us the latest regarding the situation of Palestinians held behind Israeli bars.
Well, according to a Palestinian prisoners committee, the number of Palestinian prisoners who have been engaged in the open-ended hunger strike has now reached 17. 16 of them are protesting against their illegal detention, the so-called administrative detention that Israel uses to keep Palestinian prisoners behind bars without charge or trial. They claim that they have some secret information that keep them behind bars. However, there's nothing against them, but those Palestinians could be known for taking part in protests or demonstrations or even express various social media. Now, Israel uses the so-called administrative detention, as we said, in order to arrest and hold Palestinians without charge or trial. A number of the Palestinians who are on hunger strike now have been moved to solitary confinement. The Israeli prison authorities are trying to force those Palestinians to end their hunger strike because Israel prefers to be intransigent in dealing with their legal demands so as to prevent other Palestinians from following the same path in the future and to declare being engaged in open-ended hunger strikes. Mm-hmm.
Now, Professor Namra, regarding the situation of the Palestinian prisoners, what can be done? Are they not part of the international community, not normal human beings? Where are the international organizations? I mean, and especially this administrative detention thing. I mean, every 6 months, how many times do they want to extend it? They simply go on and extend it. No evidence, no proof, nothing?
This administrative arrest was introduced first during the British mandate on Palestine, 1945. So it was one of the emergency laws that the British, before they left Palestine, introduced. And the irony that the Zionist organizations, terrorist organization, then they call it as a barbarian law. Now, after 1967, Israel is using the same law against the Palestinians to arrest anyone without pressing charges or interrogation or even trial for a period of 6 months, which is absolutely against the international law and a violation to the international law. And then it can be renewed after 6 months continuously. We have cases of Palestinians who had spent 12 years in a row on administrative arrest. And it's the worst kind of arrest because you never know your fate. You are going, if you are sentenced, you know that in such and such date you are going to be released. But in the case of the administrative arrest, you don't know because it might be, you know, renewed once after another. So it's really, the situation is very bad for those, and that's what caused them to go for a hunger strike, or part of them, and now they are preparing in prison for the whole bunch of Palestinians who are arrested under administrative arrest. Around 550 of them are going for a general strike to support those in general strike earlier. So this law is absolutely against the international law, and I think that the Geneva Convention and the custodians of the Geneva Conventions and those countries who signed on Geneva Convention should also interfere in such case and condemn Israel for this matter and try to put it up even into the United Nations and in the international community to condemn Israel for its actions against the Palestinian prisoners, which is against the international law and against the human rights and human laws. So what we need from the international community to put some focus on the issue of the Palestinian prisoners, not only for the reason of the administrative arrest, which is the best case also to talk about it, but also about the ill treatments for the sick persons, prisoners in prison, who some of them died during the interrogation or because of the bad treatment and the lack of really treatment, medical treatment for them. So all these situations for the Palestinian prisoners is absolutely violating to the international law and to the human rights law, and it's about time that the international community should take a step regarding what's going on for the Palestinian prisoners.
Hopefully, especially in these COVID times. Thank you very much for your comments. Mona Kandil, our correspondent, joined us from Ramallah, also Saad Nim, professor of political science with Berzaichi University. And that's it for this edition of the News Review.
Iran has dismissed Israeli accusations that it was involved in an attack on an Israeli-owned oil tanker off the coast of Oman late on Thursday.
We condemn the Israeli comments. The regime should know that leveling such accusations leads them nowhere. Iran will not hesitate to defend the interests of its people and its national security.
Hatibzadeh added that the Israeli accusations are completely baseless. He noted that the regime is the root cause of insecurity in the region and that regional players backing Israel are responsible for such insecurity. The U.S. said on Friday that the attack on the Israeli-affiliated ship was carried out by a drone. Washington and Tel Aviv immediately blamed Iran for the incident without providing any evidence. But resistance sources told Iran's Al-Alam Arabic News Network that the attack was in retaliation for a recent deadly Israeli air raid on an airport in Syria's western Fosir region. Political analyst Tim Anderson says it's simply convenient for Israel to level accusations against Iran for any incidents such as a recent attack on its tanker off of Oman.
The Israelis certainly have plenty of enemies. They've been attacking Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, subversively Iran. They're involved in subversion against Yemen. So there's a number of enemies who are not very happy with the idea of Israeli shipping going into the Persian Gulf. Having said that, of course, there is a reason to suspect Iran because Israel itself has attacked at least a dozen Iranian ships in the last 2 years, according to the Wall Street Journal earlier this year, and Israeli media have reported that too. So there's a very open, semi-open type of hostility going on. I think the Israeli leader, Bennett, is talking about intelligence evidence, which is just a code word for that's what they think or what they would like to think. So I think in view of the Iranian denial, it's not so clear, but in any case, it doesn't really seem to matter that much because the Israelis have been attacking willy-nilly large numbers sites around the region, and they have threatened to retaliate in any case. I don't think evidence matters to the Israelis, and I think that the enemies of Israel are going to be ready for another attack, basically. I don't think evidence matters that much in this situation.
Now we're turning to Lebanon, where there are reports that we're getting in that a group of Shia mourners have come under attack in a town south of the capital, Beirut. So far, at least 3 deaths have been confirmed. I'm going to cross over to Beirut and talk to Mariam Saleh to bring me the latest. Mariam, tell us what you know.
Well, so far we're getting news about around 4 people who have been martyred during this shooting. We don't have official reports, whether it is from Hezbollah or any medical source that is giving us exactly how many people have been killed. We know that there are continuous clashes as we speak. This was an issue that actually started out as a result of a vendetta shooting that occurred last night. But the actual events or the reasons for this goes back around a year, around last year, during the time of Ashura, the Ashura decisions. And as you know, there are the areas that are mixed, and one of them is this area of Jabalia in south of Beirut. We have a Shiite community. We also have a Sunni community. And that Sunni community specifically is the Arab Bedouins that were given Lebanese nationality back in the 1990s and have settled in Lebanon ever since. And we had even some of them accused of dealing with Daesh and other extremist groups. And so that began during the time of mourning when, you know, the Shiites hold processions, they raise slogans and banners and so on, and that resulted in certain small clashes, and one of the Arabs at the point was killed. Now we have, after a year almost, the brother of that person that was killed during those clashes decided to go for a vendetta, and he killed this person whom he is the owner of that area, of that commercial area, which where the clashes took place. And so during the mourning of this, the Shiite mourners, that was when there was an ambush, and they saw that there was fire against them from all sides, and that is when we know that there were at least 3 people that had fallen. We have more people, and most of them are the relatives of Mr. Shibli, as we know. His name is, was killed yesterday in what seemed also like an ambush. He was basically assassinated during a wedding at a relative. So now it seems that even when Hezbollah decided, of course, after this killing, called on the Shia community to please be calm, to be patient, to act and wait for justice to be served through the criminals of the government, that the army be there for responsible for security and so on, and the mourners were going to take this the funeral from the house of this the martyr in Khaldi II, his hometown in South Lebanon. That was when the clashes occurred. So what we know now is that the Hezbollah is calling on the security apparatus, the Lebanese army, to try to take control of the area. They are blaming this mentality, as they call Hezbollah in one of their statements, that this is a mentality of chaos, extremism, hatred from one side to another side, and these efforts, continuous efforts, to sow sedition among the various sects inside Lebanon, that this is probably one of the projects that is being inflamed as a result. And this will, of course, we're going to be keep you updated on anything that we know.
Okay, Mariam, I definitely will be checking back, and of course, Lebanon, as she said, it's very sensitive right now, and we're watching it very closely. Mariam Saleh out of Beirut. Now to Afghanistan, where three rockets have struck the Kandahar airport in the southern part of the country as the Taliban press ahead with their offensive. The chief of the Kandahar airport said the attack happened overnight, with at least two rockets hitting the runway. The official added that all flights were canceled due to the assault. Now he said the work is underway to repair the runway. The Taliban have claimed responsibility. The militants have recently launched sweeping attacks on the outskirts of Kandahar, raising fears that they are on the verge of capturing the provincial capital. Fierce clashes are also underway in several cities and provinces as the group is inching closer to take provincial capitals, including Herat in the west and Lashkar Gah in the south. And now to Japan, where people in the capital have held a fresh protest to call for the cancellation of the Tokyo Olympics amid a spike in coronavirus cases. Some of the protesters accused Japanese officials of using the ongoing Olympic Games for political purposes. Similar protests were held in Tokyo over the past days. On Sunday, the city registered more than 3,000 new COVID-19 cases. A day earlier, infections there hit a record high of over 4,000. Authorities blamed the surge on the highly transmissible Delta variant, denying any link with the Olympics. On Friday, the government extended a state of emergency in Tokyo and expanded it to neighboring prefectures. And with that, it brings us to the end of this World News Bulletin.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
An internal slide presentation assembled by officials at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention warns that the Delta variant of the coronavirus, now dominant strain in the U.S. and across much of the world, is as transmissible as chickenpox, could lead to more extreme illness than earlier mutations, and can likely be spread by people who are fully vaccinated. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jake Johnson, writer. This article is published under the heading A Very Serious Threat. CDC document warns Delta variant is as contagious as chickenpox. Stay tuned for more. An internal slide presentation assembled by officials at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention warns that the Delta variant of the coronavirus, now the dominant strain in the U.S. and across much of the world, is as transmissible as chickenpox, could lead to more extreme illness than earlier mutations, and can likely be spread by people who are fully vaccinated. First obtained by the Washington Post recently, the document states that the Delta variant may cause more severe disease than Alpha or ancestral strains, citing data on hospitalizations and deaths in Canada, Scotland, and Singapore, while noting that people who are fully inoculated against COVID-19 can still catch and spread the Delta variant. The document stresses that vaccines are extremely effective in preventing severe illness and death. Delta is different from previous strains. One of the slides reads, summarizing that the variant is highly contagious, likely more severe, and breakthrough infections may be as transmissible as unvaccinated cases. The presentation says Delta is more contagious than Ebola, the seasonal flu, the flu of 1918, and smallpox. Dr. Rachel Walensky, the director of the CDC, confirmed the authenticity of the leaked document in an interview with CNN. I think people need to understand that we are not crying wolf here. This is serious, Walensky said, adding, it's one of the most transmissible viruses we know about. Chickenpox, this, they're all up there. An unnamed federal official told the New York Times that the CDC is expected to publish additional data on the Delta variant. The CDC is very concerned with the data coming in that Delta is a very serious threat that requires action now, the official said. Some public health experts who reviewed the CDC document said they are now even more worried about the Delta variant, which was first detected in India in December and has since spread to more than 100 countries. The U.S. is currently averaging around 71,000 new coronavirus cases a day, with more than 80% of those attributable to the Delta strain. I finished reading it significantly more concerned than when I began, Robert Watcher, chairman of the Department of Medicine at the University of California at San Francisco, told the Post. But Dr. Ashish Jha, dean of the Brown University School of Public Health, said that while the document makes clear the Delta variant is a major issue, he found the presentation to be largely reassuring. Bottom line, yeah, Delta variant is bad. Like, really bad, Jahar wrote in a series of tweets recently, but he added, our vaccines are good, like really good. Breakthrough infections happen. Sometimes they may spread to others, but if enough people get a shot, the pandemic does come to an end. In addition to full vaccination, the CDC document recommends universal masking as a way to control the spread of the Delta variant. That advice is significantly more sweeping than the guidance the CDC released to the public earlier this week, which recommended that vaccinated people wear masks in public indoor spaces only in areas of the country where cases are surging. The agency's presentation surfaced as the administration announced recently that federal civilian employees who do not show proof of vaccination will be required to wear a mask, undergo coronavirus testing once or twice per week, and socially distance. Biden said in a speech recently, last month, a study showed that over 99% of COVID-19 deaths had been among the unvaccinated. People are dying and will die who don't have to die. If you're out there unvaccinated, you don't have to die. This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Aperture. Welcome back to Aperture, everyone. In the first part of the documentary, we met the hidden victims of America's multi-billion dollar chemical industry. By offering an excellent wage and a comfortable retirement package, chemical giants Dow Chemical and DuPont factories are welcome wherever they go. For many of the town's residents, a job at Dow Chemical or DuPont marks the beginning of a very glimmering future. Yet, victims like Alice, Kenton, and Rukna have seen the ugly truth behind this prosperity. Don't go away. Here's the rest of our program.
850 children are now registered at Rashida B's center. In 2015, Dow gave $4.5 billion to its shareholders, but not a single cent has been given to the decontamination of Bhopal. For weeks, we tried to reach the communications department at Dow to get an interview, without success.
Who's going to answer those questions? It's pretty important.
I'm not aware of who that is right off the top of my head. We have 50,000 employees, so I'll have to do some research.
Dow never called us back. So we decided to go to the company's General Assembly in Midland, in the U.S., to ask our questions. A few days later, we finally received an email from Dow. The company laments, "Bhopal was a terrible tragedy that we will never forget." But they relieved themselves of all responsibility, stating that, "We acquired Union Carbide more than 16 years after the catastrophe of 1984.
Dow continues to address global issues through human solutions. Issues like clean water, as important as life itself. Dow is working to make water safe and readily available to people all over the globe. The human element. Nothing is more fundamental. Nothing more elemental."
In Dow's wake, countless victims and human tragedies pile up without any damage to the company's profits. In December 2015, Dow announced the biggest financial operation in its history. A merger of $130 billion with another American chemical giant, DuPont. A match made in heaven.
You and DuPont, there's a lot of good chemistry between us.
DuPont made its fortune with dynamite.
Dynamite!
Nylon and Teflon, the magical material that prevents food from sticking to pans. However, behind the success of Teflon, DuPont hides a dark secret.
I just can't believe that DuPont, the money means more than people.
There's people dying because of what they've done.
DuPont knew years ago what they were doing.
At best, it's despicable. At the worst, it's criminal.
At the heart of this drama is one city, Parkersburg. Lost in the eastern U.S. The city was built around the DuPont factory. Suzanne Bailey came here in 1978 to work on the Teflon production lines.
I went to work in May the 8th, 1978. That was my glorious day, right there. They took our pictures.
It's you?
That's me, without gray hair.
In the middle?
Yep. You know, I was so happy.
You're smiling.
I was. That was the elite job. I mean, everybody wanted to go there because of, for the money, for the benefits, and everything like that. It was secure.
The chemical industry is a growing one, growing by leaps and bounds.
I mean, you could just mention the DuPont name and doors swung open. It was like princes coming through the door, you know?
Yes, in such an environment, you can look to a bright future with confidence and optimism.
Were you happy, sir?
I was thrilled. I was absolutely thrilled to death.
A few months after starting her job at DuPont, Suzanne Bailey became pregnant. In January of 1981, she gives birth to little Bucky.
When he was born, it was very traumatic. They didn't know what to do with him. They'd never seen anything like it. I could not figure out what happened. He had half a nostril, half a nose, the eye as a keyhole pupil. I didn't know what to do. I was afraid he was going to die in my arms. I had no idea what was wrong.
Bucky survived. He is now 35 years old. But his childhood was spent between his home and the hospital.
I had 30 surgeries in a span of, 6 to 7 years, where they took rib cartilage to form my nose. I have a metal plate here. They stretched my forehead out so that they could use that skin and bring it down and mold my nose here. I still only have one nostril, functioning nostril.
We had to put the hockey mask on him and the guards because he wasn't allowed to touch his face.
For how long?
He had to wear those for, I would say, 3 months, 4 months.
It's a long time.
Yeah, the only way that he got to take him off was just to eat.
How is it as a kid to grow up and to have, so many surgeries? And I mean, it's pretty intense,
Walking out in public and going into a store or a restaurant, and as soon as you enter, all the eyes are on you. And school, when you go in and you're trying to make new friends, all they see is you're different.
After her maternity leave, Suzanne Bailey began to suspect her job as the cause of Bucky's deformities. A mysterious source tips her off to one molecule in particular, C8, the molecule in Teflon that stops food from sticking to pans.
When I went back to work the first day, I went to the locker and I found the paper laying there. I picked it up and I began reading about it. It was talking about how the rats were fed the C8 and what deformities that it had around their face. And I thought, that sounds just like Bucky.
It was very similar to what Bucky had.
Absolutely. Very similar, almost identical to what he had. That's why I knew that there was something wrong. That's why I connect.
The scientific study Suzanne Bailey found had been conducted by a subcontractor of DuPont. It studied baby rats whose mothers were exposed to C8. They developed abnormal eye lenses.
I immediately walked out that door, went down to medical, and I said, is this what's wrong with my baby? Oh, no, no, no. Nothing on this plant will hurt you. That was the motto. That's what they always say.
Yeah.
Nothing here will hurt you.
But in the meantime, DuPont was secretly investigating the pregnant women working in their factory. 2 out of 7 children born to the factory workers had facial deformities like Bucky. Shortly after, DuPont decided to transfer Suzanne Bailey and her colleagues to other departments. At the time, Kenton Wamsley also worked in the manufacturing department of Teflon. He remembers the discussion he had with his manager.
He said, Ken, we sent all the women home out of Teflon, all of them. He said, oh, don't worry. It won't hurt the men, just the women. We feel that it can cause trouble. So I thought, won't hurt me.
Kenton Wamsley was a lab technician. He handled C8 for 30 years.
Breathe the fumes from them, all the samples we breathe. But we just, at the time we thought DuPont would take care of us. And so I just did my jobs for years and years, And we didn't realize that our health was an issue then. Surgeon diagnosed me as having cancer. He had to take all my rectum, part of my colon.
Now Kenton Wamsley has to live with an ostomy bag attached to his stomach. He changes it day and night. At the factory, he worked in a team with three other technicians.
My buddies, people I really love. Seen them every day. Cared about them. Those guys are all dead, and I should have been. They didn't even see retirement. None of them.
Wamsley and his colleagues were never warned about the risks of C8. However, we procured a confidential document from DuPont. It's dated 1982, 34 years ago. In it, Mr. Rector at the time expresses concern about the consequences of C8 retained in the blood of employees. He specifically recommends that practical steps be taken to reduce this exposure.
All employees, not just Teflon area workers, are exposed. So rather than to do anything, they just wrote it out. I've never seen a letter like that. I'm mad. You can see why. We could have prevented a lot of lives if they would have told us there's a problem. Why'd they cover it up? Why'd they lie? Why didn't they have us protected? Too costly?
We track down Bruce Carr, DuPont's former medical director. He is now enjoying a peaceful retirement by the ocean, far from Parkersburg.
I have a document of 1982 showing that you were aware that C8 was toxic for workers. Why have you not told them the truth at that time?
They were all told the truth. They were told everything we knew at the time.
Actually, no. I have interviewed some employees and they were not aware of anything.
We told employees everything we knew as soon as we knew it. You go back to 1982, you're trying to do reconstruction history, and you can't do that.
Why have you not protected your employees? Il a raccroché.
DuPont would not only put their employees in danger. Once again, tens of thousands of people would be affected. They live up to 70 kilometers away from the factory. One man would discover this, a bit by accident. Joe Kiger. On October 31st, 2000, he receives a letter from the municipality concerning the quality of the tap water. It mentions C8.
I was sitting in my courtyard, and the wife was watering the flowers, and we got our water bill in the mail, and with that bill came a letter. It's like you get form letters all the time. So you look and say, oh, okay, bang, and you put it over and you don't think about it. Next thing you know, you throw it away. And that's basically what this was. It just caught my attention, and I started reading through it, and then the flag started popping up. First of all, what was C8 here, which is used by DuPont Works? Well, what's DuPont have to do with our water?
Joe Kiger sought clarification on the matter.
I called DuPont to try to find out. So they put me in touch with a guy, a gentleman named Mr. Kennedy, and I said, you know, I'd like to know more about this C8 issue. He just told me it's nothing to worry about. It was just a byproduct of Teflon, and it wasn't anything to worry about. And he was flat out lying to me, I could tell that.
To get to the bottom of it, he takes DuPont to court after a long legal battle. The judge forces the company to declassify their internal studies on C8. Joe Kiger discovers the truth behind the factory at Parkersburg. For decades, they've been dumping C8 waste into the river. To make things worse, DuPont has known since 1984 that the molecule spread into the region's tap water. The company found astronomical levels in public taps, up to 50 times the limit of toxicity, according to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency.
That was 1984, and we didn't come out till 2000.
So 16 years.
Yeah, before we even hit them up about it. And they chose, as you see right here, they chose not to do anything about it. And they knew what was coming with the liabilities if they got caught. They were trying to slide under the radar. People trusted DuPont for so long. They have done nothing but lie
for years to people about what this stuff's all about. There's sick people out here because of what they've done. There's people dying because of what they've done.
During all these years, more than 70,000 people have been drinking contaminated water. In 2011, both scientific research and the U.S. justice system established that C8 could cause six diseases: thyroid disorder, high cholesterol, ulcerative colitis, high blood pressure, kidney cancer, or testicular cancer. Today, 3,500 people in the Parkersburg region are ill. They've all filed complaints against DuPont. This is the case for Earl and Gwen Botkin.
I've had ulcerative colitis for about 17 years, and it's about killed me a couple times. I still have thyroid problem, and I have high cholesterol. And those are all associated with C8.
Today, Earl Botkin doesn't have a colon anymore. He, too, is living with an ostotomy bag.
So all of a sudden, you don't function normally, but you have your bowel movement on your side. And that's what I'll live with until I die. And there's not any hope that that's going to change. It controls where I go, what I do, and what I eat. And just controls a lot of things in my life. But anyway, I lived through that.
A document reveals that all of these victims could have been spared. On May 22nd, 1984, a meeting took place at the DuPont headquarters. The directors are worried about the consequences for the inhabitants. They plan to eliminate all C8 emissions.
I wanted to show you these sentences here.
But finally, no measures are taken. Their argument, it's not economically attractive.
That was in what year?
84. That's before we were married. That's a long time ago.
Yeah.
Long, long time ago.
That's crazy. That's what makes it so bad, you know, that they had evidence all along and just disregarded it and kept doing what they were doing.
It was company greed that caused this whole situation. They knew what they were doing to us, and they continued to do it for money. That's the only reason they continued to do it.
DuPont refuses to collectively compensate the 3,500 sick people. They prefer to study the cases one by one. As a result, since 2012, only one victim has been able to get a trial. DuPont was sentenced to pay her $1.6 million. The 3,499 remaining victims, like Earl Botkin, are still waiting. At the current pace of the trials, the last one would take place in 100 years.
Do you still trust and you're still confident that you will get a trial at some point?
Oh.
He lives long enough.
If I live to be 150, I'm right. It's there will be a trial someday. But the chances of me living long enough to ever see that are probably slim to none. But we're just another document, another number of cases to be tried. DuPont has made billions of dollars. I think they should stand up to what they've done and make it right with the people they've made sick.
DuPont refused all of our requests for an interview, so we drove to their headquarters in Delaware on the East Coast to convince them to answer our questions. At the other end of the line, we reach the head of media relations, Daniel Turner.
We are doing a documentary piece. The best way is, you know, we meet and to make a proper interview, you know, at some point. But first, let's meet. You know, I'm just here.
We'll respectfully decline the on-camera interview. I will provide you with a statement.
You know, there is like an incredible amount of documents showing that you have known at DuPont for the past 30 years that C8 was toxic. And you know that you were poisoning your employees at the Washington Works plant,
and the Parkersburg citizen. Why are you not recognizing the fact that you have deliberately poisoned thousands of persons?
Okay, so are those the questions you're asking?
Yeah, this is my questions.
Okay, I'll be happy to provide with our statement.
Today, we are in 2016. There are still 3,500 persons with severe disease that are waiting to just have the right to get a trial. I mean, for how long are you going to deny your responsibility? Are you waiting that they all die?
So, we will provide you with a statement for your peace.
Nothing else? No?
Like I said, we will provide you with a statement. Thanks so much. Have a good day. Bye.
Bye.
We did receive a press release from DuPont, but without a single word for the victims. They claim to have studied C8 carefully for decades and affirm to have always acted responsibly. In 2015, DuPont finally stopped using C8. The company was also ordered by the courts to clean up the region. But how many generations are still to experience the after effects of this contamination? In the chemical world, history inexorably tends to repeat itself. It takes decades to reveal the truth, and just as many years for the multinationals to be prosecuted. In their laboratories, new toxic molecules are constantly being developed. But in 10, 20, 30, or 40 years, who knows how many new victims will be poisoned?
Merged together, Dow Chemical and DuPont create the world's largest chemical company in terms of sales. Yet, the victims' testimonies, those whose lives have been poisoned, will forever cast a shadow over this industry as they fight in the hope that someday their culprits will be brought to justice. And that's it for this week, everyone. Join us next time for another documentary. It's goodbye.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.